the tonight's topic, and please feel free to unmute yourself and add comments or questions. Tonight's topic is, but Rabbi, it's my family's minhag to talk in shul. So it's a real quote. Once my father-in-law was telling a kid not to talk in shul, and the kid said that with all honesty. So the question is, how do you know when something is a minhag and when something's not a minhag? That's the question that we're gonna try to figure out. How do you decide when something is a valid minhag, when it's an invalid minhag? And we're gonna take one big look at the whole topic of minhagim, how it fits into halacha. When do we say that comes a minhag and changes the halacha? And when do we say that halacha trumps a minhag? Okay, so I'm gonna have three questions, and we're gonna have some stories and hopefully some chizik because of the fast day. So the first Midrash is about a fast as well. It goes as follows. I'm going to share my screen and switch off between sharing my screen and regular Zoom. So here we go. The first source is like this, that the Gemara says when a person's in a certain place, they should always follow the minhag. How do you know? Amrei b'tachon baruch ani loy lo'olam. Al yishana adam in a minhag. A person is always very careful to follow minhag. Why? How do you know this? Sherei Moshe alal marom v'loch alechem, because Moshe Rabbeinu went on Har Sinai. He went up to heaven. He got the Torah, and he looked around and he saw what's on the menu in Shemayim. Did they have any good Zadies or any fire poppers? Nothing. He saw that no one ate anything. Not the sushi rolls. Not they didn't have any of the cafeteria food, so he didn't eat anything. However, the other way around, and when the angels came to Earth, they came to visit Avraham Avinu. So what happened? Achulachem, they came and ate. The three angels that came and visited Avraham, they ate with them. Right? What were they doing? They really need to stop over for a tongue sandwich. What was the big deal that they came to eat? But nonetheless, they looked around. They saw everybody was eating. They ate as well. Did they really eat? And they themselves like they ate. So, I saw a great question. I don't understand. What does this mean that we learn the idea of a minhag from the fact that Moshe didn't eat when he went to Shemayim? Imagine a guy goes to a restaurant. And he sees it's a pizza store, and they have sushi and pizza and cheese pretzels and french fries, and he sees everybody that day is just eating tuna sandwiches. So now he has to follow the minhag. He can't go and order pizza today. Minhag. That's what it says in the Gemara. Or the other way around. A guy comes, and everybody's playing toy, everybody's playing games, everybody's playing whatever. Today everybody's playing cards. So he's not allowed to play any other game today. Everybody's reading Harry Potter. What exactly is the Gemara talking about? People eat because we're hungry. So the angels aren't hungry. They have to do Orman Hag. They have to eat. And then Moshe went to Shemayim and said, oh, wait, no one's eating over here. Oh, I can't eat. What's that mean that there's a minhag not to eat? It doesn't relate to anything. It's just, if everybody's wearing a blue shirt, I have to blend in and wear a blue shirt? So just because we eat, that's not a halakha that we eat. We eat because we're hungry. So it's not a minhag. It's just like if everybody wear a blue shirt. Why should I wear a blue shirt also? Okay, the famous quote, two quote, if everybody jumped off the cliff, would you jump also? What's the meaning behind that the angels ate when they came to Earth and Moshe didn't eat when he went to Shemayim? That's the first question I want to think about. Any ideas, answers? If it's not a compelling question, then we'll have others.
Because you would think that a minhag would relate to a halacha. So it's not just the mannerisms or the customs of what people do. The minhag has almost a status of a halacha. So it should be related to a halacha, not just something that people do.
Right. Okay. So there we go. What exactly does it mean that they had a minhag about that Moshe didn't eat when he went to Shemayim? Shalom Isaac, so good to see everybody. Let me see. Okay, is that hot me? I can't see. Okay, so now we see the next source. Here we go. The Radvaz, they're talking about lots of old minhagim. There's tshuvas and tshuvas and stories, hundreds, about what happens when you minhag, and it's and the reason doesn't make sense anymore. For example, the Radvaz says like this. They used to have a minhag, and actually, in fact, they still do this minhag today. A minhag that when a woman would get divorced, chas v'shalom, they'd bring the get in front of the Beit Din, and the Beit Din would tear it up. They would see, make sure, certify that it's authentic, and she's divorced, and then they would rip it up. So why would they rip it up? Their advisors asked. They said, why don't they keep it? It should be make sure that she's able to remarry. They should hold on to the document. What are they shredding the document, shredding evidence? This is, I don't know, whatever. This is Madoff, Enron. Why are they burning the evidence? So Radvaz says like this. He says, first of all, he said, because it's a practical reason. Okay, there's a monetary reason. With a get, a woman's able to collect her ksuba. She's able to collect money from her husband. Okay, fine. That's a practical reason. And we don't want her to collect twice. Okay, very good. The second reason he says, that's not my focus. My focus is the second one. He says, you know what? Because there was one time in history when the Goyim made a gezerah. They said, we're going to persecute, we're going to destroy anybody that is giving a get to his wife, and the wife is holding on to the get. So what they do, secret, undercover, they had a get, ceremony, giving of the get, and then immediately they tear it up so there's no evidence of it, so the Goyim wouldn't ever catch the guy from and wouldn't persecute them. So now, we don't live in that time, says the Radvaz. We're living in the 1500s in Egypt. And there was no persecution about this. There was no gezeirah. You couldn't do a get. So then all of a sudden he says, why they rip it up? He said, because I'll tell you, once we had a minhag, we continued the minhag, even though it doesn't matter, even though it doesn't make sense, even though the practice is totally gone. That's my second question. What does that mean to have a minhag, to follow a practice that people used to follow, if it doesn't make sense anymore? Why do we continue something that doesn't hold any water anymore? What I meant today that the people do it is the Beit Din holds on to a copy of it and they don't give it back to the woman. After the woman gets divorced, on Shoshan, then it happens that they put it on file. And the Beit Din, this way, there's no questions on the get anymore. It was authenticated and that was it. But anyway, why should the second reason the Radvaz apply if it doesn't make sense anymore? Now, Everybody talks about many examples of minhagim. People talk about, for example, kidneyot. Is that an example? Maybe the reason doesn't apply anymore. Or they talk about gibrux, that Ashkenazim, that Hasidim, they won't eat any matzah that was put in water. Matzah meal, I don't know, there are probably many, many other good minhagim. Some of them, it seems like the reason doesn't apply anymore. And yet, we still keep it. For 2 days of Yom Tov, we do that. And it seemingly doesn't apply anymore. Right? The Minag Avotam B'Yadam, we still follow the practice to have 2 days. Why? Not because we don't know the calendar, because that's what they used to do. So the question is, why does that make any sense? Why should we have to keep a Minag that the reason doesn't apply? Any thoughts? Suggestions? One more example of the same thing. The Gemara in Ketubot, now this is not the practice anymore, but it says it used to be the practice that a person would get married, a first marriage they would do on Wednesday night. Okay, first, whatever it was. And the Gemara says, why did they get married on Wednesday nights? Instead of tonight, nowadays it's on Sundays, everybody gets married Sundays, in the less busy season, you know, there's Monday nights and Thursday nights. But why was it Wednesday night? The Gemara said, because of Gezerah. There was once a Gezerah that the Romans had, terrible Gezerah, that they were going to do terrible things to the woman, take them and do something wrong if they got married, and the Jews had to switch up the nights when they were getting married, so this way the Goyim, the Romans, would never come in, figure out which nights. And the Gemara said, okay, it worked out that Wednesday night was night that worked out very well. So the Gemara says, in the days of the Mishnah, 300 years later, after the Churban Abayit, they still had to practice, keep it on a Wednesday night. The Yerushalmi says, why do we keep it on a Wednesday night? It doesn't make sense anymore. It's like, imagine if in Poland 200 years ago they said, no doing Shchita on Tuesdays. So they did Shchita on Wednesday. So, oh, today, all of a sudden, the Aaron's company has to close down shop on Tuesdays. Are the people even, that's not, that's just a joke, but they have a real minhag that people talk about. Do you learn on Xmas, on December 25th? In the yeshivas, they say, maybe no learning. Why no learning on the December 25th? Because if you look on the old Jewish calendars, you can go in any Jewish museum from the last 500 years, the calendars all had marked off December 25th as a night when there's no shul and no learning. Why? Pashut, because 100 years ago, in lots of different places, unfortunately, there were pogroms on their holidays. So they couldn't learn Torah. That's what now the Chasam Sofer lived in Hungary 200 years ago, and that was his practice. So should we keep this practice? Some people thought yes. To me, it's a little bit like a joke. What are we keeping a practice from 200 years ago if the reason doesn't apply anymore? No Torah, December 25th. What's that about? Okay, any suggestions? Why did the Ravaz keep up a minhag? The reason was dead. The reason didn't apply.
Maybe because they want to teach us that tradition is something very important that we have to try to keep.
Okay. Maybe. Okay, so I'll have to see. Why is it so important to follow minhag, even if the reason wouldn't apply? Very interesting.
Maybe in some of those cases, like with getting married on Wednesday night, I think there were different opinions in the Gemara and also about the Beit Din being open on Thursday, which that also wouldn't necessarily apply. But I think there was also an opinion that said there's another reason for it, that there's a different reason. And so for some of those, or also Yom Tov Sheni, Shabbat Galut, there may be more behind it than just the calendar. So some of those things may have more reason than we're just discussing. And then in the cases, other cases that you mentioned where it seems like maybe there wasn't really other reason, maybe the reason that they first instituted the minhag, it's important to us to remember or to commemorate why that was instituted in the first place.
Okay, I like that. Okay, good suggestions, good ideas. Thank you, Sally. Okay, so let me focus on the third question now. The third question goes like this. Sometimes we meet Minhagim, as Torah goes and Judaism goes, Minhagim is the Pandora box or whatever, the mystery box that you can get just about a minhagim about anything. You go to interesting communities, you go to people's houses for Shabbos, you ask them what they do in their shul, and people do interesting things. Someone asked Rav Moshe, my father had a practice never, not even on Pesach, not during the rest of the year, to eat gibrux. He wouldn't eat matzah meal made into matzah balls. At one point, there was a shtick in the yeshiva. People talked about the chumrah of the week, chumrah of the month. This would be the chumrah of the year. This would top all the chumras that anybody could have. You can never have gebrux, matzah meal, anything. So the person asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, do I have to follow my father's practice? And he said, it doesn't make any sense. He said, gebrux, the idea that some chassidim have that they don't eat it on Pesach, I'll explain. That makes some sense. Why? Because maybe the matzah that they made wasn't perfectly baked and totally dry, and it could be there was a little bit of flour, and therefore if you're going to put it in your soup, it could be a little chametz. We don't actually even hold like that. We hold it's not going to be chametz. We're very confident. But even though that's true, I can understand someone is strict on that. However, and they say the Vilna Gaon was not strict, and in the chassidim there were machmir on it, the Vilna Gaon took a matzah ball and put it in his window. That's he advertised to Vilna in the 1700s. He advertised to everybody, I don't hold the gebrux minhag. But either way, nobody holds it the rest of the year, says Rav Moshe. Do you eat chametz during the rest of the year? He said, yeah, of course I eat chametz. So he said, if you eat chametz, why is gebrux any more serious than chametz? Of course you eat chametz the rest of the year, so what are you not eating gebrux the rest of the year? He said he doesn't think that the minhag has any validity. You can't make up minhagim unless it's actually being strict for an opinion, or it's concerned about some isur, is concerned about something. And if you have a chumrah that just doesn't base on anything, it's not considered of binding minhag. Someone says they don't want to eat potato chips on every third Wednesday. So that doesn't carry any halachic significance as a minhag. You can make a neder, you can take upon yourself whatever you want, but it doesn't become a minhag just because you decided, you know, no parking on alternate side every third Thursday. That's a silly thing that doesn't become a minhag. That's what Moshe said about the gebruchs all year chumrah. The other example I want to give about this was that someone asked another question to Rav Moshe. He said, if you have in a certain community a certain clothing that they wear, am I allowed to change from that? For example, the Hasidim, they all wear bekishes on Shabbos. They all wear strimals during the week, whatever. They all wear fancy garb. The way that they used to wear in Poland. Said someone asked Rav Moshe, am I allowed to change from that? It's breaking from the minhag. And every time someone's breaking from the minhag, you always get up with a pitchfork. We always have to stone them and say, tradition, what are they doing? So how, says Rav Moshe, someone asked Rav Moshe, how is it allowed that we're allowed not to wear strimals and bekishes and the way they wore in Hungary 100 years ago? And Rav Moshe said the same answer as he had in the Gebruchs all year chumrah, tshuva, and he said, the Gemara gives plenty of examples that are not binding minhagim. He says, if somebody says, I'm not going to sit on a bench near the Goyim's town, is that a minhag? The Gemara says, that's nothing. It's not. If someone says they're not going to travel on a Friday not to come to violate Shabbat, that's a minhag. The Gemara gives an example. But someone saying they're not going to sit on a bench, that's not binding. Says Rav Moshe, this minhag about what clothing we're wearing is not a binding minhag. He says it doesn't have any reason. Now, he said, if it is because its clothing is not tzanua or has gaiva, okay, that he says could be binding. But basically, that's defending the practice of most people that don't have to follow the minhag of the Hasidim, that follow only the Hasidic clothing the way it was 100 years ago. My question is, if we said before that minhagim may be so important that we keep the minhag even when it doesn't make any sense, like we said from the Radvaz that they're ripping up the get, or we said the getting married on a Wednesday night, even though the gezeirah was removed, they kept it. Why is it that when it comes to minhagim that don't make sense, all of a sudden it sounds like we don't have to keep them? Okay, and better yet, there's going to be, on the other hand, we're going to have minhagim that are the counter pressure that even though they don't make sense, they never made sense, yet some people say to upkeep those minhagim. Okay? Let me give some examples of that. And then I'll do some of the makorah, and then I'll finish summarizing the three questions. So, one second, I have to pull up my nose. Okay. Until I get in my notes, the three questions are like this. Question number one was, why did the angels eat food when they came to the ground, earth? Because the meaning of people is to eat. That's like the meaning of having a blue shirt. It doesn't make any sense. And why did the angels have to eat just because we eat? And why did Moshe have to not eat because they didn't eat? It's like I go into the bar and I have to eat sushi because everybody else chose to eat sushi. That's the first question. And why does the Gemara say we learn from there the importance of minhagim? The second question is, why do the Radvaz say we have to keep minhagim that don't make any sense anymore, even because at one time did make sense? And then the third question is, when do you know if a minhag is valid and when it's not valid based on the fact that it seems not to make sense? The example they gave from Rav Moshe were the gebruchs all year, and he said that we have to throw out that minhag, but yet, I'm going to try to give other examples that seem to be a counter pressure. Okay, let me just get my notes up on that. Any thoughts on those two minhagim I brought from Rav Moshe? Here we go. Let's just say a bunch of examples in here. First one is like this, the tour. The Torah says there's an old practice to say piyutim. This will be for my third question. Old practice, in the Ashkenazi world they do it today, and in Sephardim mostly not. Let me know if Moroccans do. Maybe on Yom Kippur they do. Krovitz, different Yotro, whatever, different piyutim they throw into certain areas of Tefillah. So they're saying the Baruch HaKriyat Shema, and they put in a whole slew of piyutim. One time it was in Minyan, that on Rosh Hashanah they were saying these piyutim in the middle of Bracha Kriyat Shema, and it was going very long, and I looked at my watch, I saw that it was time for Brachas Kriyash. It was the latest time for Shema. It was a slow minion. It was going very late. I turned to someone. I said, "Brother, maybe we should skip some piyutim. I don't want to miss the main time for Shema. Shema is min haTorah. Minhagim are just a minhag." And some people got upset. "What do you mean minhag? You can't skip a piyut." Well, guess what? The Torah said, "Of course you can't do a piyutim in Brachas Kriyas Shema. It's a hefsek. It's interruption." And he said, "Forget it. Mevatel the minhag." And he says, "If I come into a shul and I see people doing this." He doesn't get up and protest loudly, but he takes out a chumash and he learns. That's the opinion of the tour. And guess what? As often happens, you have a dispute. On the side of the tour is the Bach, Rav Yoel Sirkis in the 1600s. He writes this. He says, Sharle Murray, the Rabbeinu HaTur. He says, Hashem should forgive and pardon the grievous sin that the tour just did. He was making fun of the minhag to say piyutim during Brachas Kriyas Shema. Hashem should forgive him. You know why? Because it was such an old minhag, how dare he try to abolish it? It's not a hefsek, and he tries to explain why it's not a hefsek, and he says, these minhagim go back all the way to the Tanaim, and it comes from traditions from Eliyahu HaNavi. Okay, you can't break a minhag. So, just another generation later, it happened that the Beit Sha'arim, one of the Tshuva Sfarim, he writes about that Bach, he says, using such a harif language against the tour, Shari Lemari LeBach. Hashem should forgive the Bach for attacking and challenging the tour. The tour is right. And this often classically happens. You have back and forth, people going back and forth. So the question is, why do we try to stick our heads up? Why do we try to stick up for Minhagim if they don't make a lot of sense like the Bach did in that case? Why did the Bach try to stick up for the Minhagim purely based on the fact that it's just a Minhag? People did this. Minhag Yisrael, people have a phrase, Minhag Yisrael, Torah. If you have a minhag, it's biblical, it's from the Torah, it's halakha. There's a phrase that comes from Masechet Sofrim, minhag oker halakha. Minhag comes and uproots the halakha. Now the conservatives, in the 1800s took this and developed it. That the minhag is to drive on Shabbat. Now, Chas HaShalom, we take that, but this is a halachic source. It's from the Gemara, Minhag Oker Halacha. It's from Yerushalmi, Tosas and Baba Metzia, the beginning of the Parakut. What does that mean? So now my three questions are, why did Moshe Rabbeinu not eat when he went to Shemaim? It's just a minhag not to eat. It's a minhag to eat sushi when everybody else around you is eating sushi. The second question was, why do we keep up minhagim seemingly when the reasons don't apply to Radvaz? And the third question is, how do you know to evaluate which minhagim are valid and which ones aren't? I said the Gebrucks all year Chumra is invalid, but yet we seem to have other examples like the Bach trying to defend the Piyutim example, as we said before. Any thoughts on this before we're going to try to work out, try to get through the nitty-gritty of what makes minhagim tick, and then the styles in the postgame. Any thoughts? How do you know if a good minhag versus a bad minhag?
It would seem that a minhag should not be allowed to be over halakha. Not be allowed to be to contradict halakha. And if the Gemara says that there are times when minhag is over halakha, then there must be a lot of strength and reason to do that minhag if it's really going to.
Okay, I accept it fully. Now you're going to see there's going to be a lot of clash and turmoil over those words, minhag oker halacha. Some people say it's all wrong, it's one big mistake, and we'll see the opposite soon. So here's a few examples of the postgame over the generations. I'm going to try to explain the styles of the postgame, and then we're going to come back to answer these three questions. But most immediately, basically, we're trying to answer the third question. How do the postgame evaluate minhagim? So the first thought is just Rav Yitzchak Yosef likes to comment that once Chacham Ben Sion Abashol, the one of the Rashi Yeshiva of Port Yosef, the Chavruta of Chacham Avadya, the Or Letzion, a great gadol in the previous generation, he once said to Rav Yitzchak Yosef, he said, "You know the difference between me and your father, Chacham Avadya. The only difference between me and your father is minhagim. I hold minhagim, and your father doesn't." Now, that's a very stark statement, because Chacham Avadya held very minhagim, except sometimes Moroccan minhagim, every now and then he chepper on the Moroccan minhagim and the Persian minhagim, whichever Siri Minhagim, there were so many that he had to take apart. But basically, there's a big style, of a big difference between Hamavadi's approach to Minhagim. If there's anything that seems to be wrong, forget it! We go back to what the sources say. And you look at the Or Lizion, he deals with his mother's practice to light Shabbat candles. She was Sephardi. To light Shabbat candles and then make the bracha. The Ashkenazim, they make the bracha, cover their eyes, and then they make the bracha. And by the Sephardim, it's Enshel Aruch, not to do that. They should do the opposite. They should make the bracha, over Lasiyatan before they do the mitzvah. And the Or Lizion said, yeah, but I saw my mother do that way. She would do like the Ashkenazim. And the Chacham Avadia says, sorry, that's a wrong minhag. We don't follow that. I know that in Bavel, in Persia, the Persians, some people did like that, but it's not right. Why is it not right? He says, because I looked in the Rishonim and I found like 15 Rishonim that says Bracha Levatala. So it's very good. Some people did like that. Goodbye and good luck. We're not going to follow that. That's what the Yalki Yosef says. Or the Tzion writes a nice tshuva. He says, oh, I can explain, I can defend, I can answer some of the questions. Comes out with the, even starting has such a, it could, some people could have such a minhag. That's one classic example of the difference between the Ashkenaz, between the Chacham Avadia and the other schools of thought. Rabbi Lebar is a rabbi in L.A. today, Moroccan. He has Sfarim on the Moroccan Minhagim. And he loves collecting Moroccan Minhagim. Not the extreme ones, like the ones that the women don't have to listen to Megillah on at nighttime. And they don't. There's extreme Minhagim about every which way. So he doesn't. He knows how to include certain Moroccan Minhagim and not others. And he spoke for YU at some point not so long ago, and he said, "Look, my approach is not like Chacham Avadia. He got a haskama from Rav Masaz, many others. He didn't get any haskama from Rav Yitzchak Yosef. My approach is not like the approach of the Chacham Avadias. Why? Because Chacham Avadia, if he saw any pikpuk, any question on a minhag, out the door, he wouldn't hold the minhag. And I don't think like that. As long as I can find someone to rely on, that's already good enough." There's a major story, they say, once with the Bava Sali's daughter getting married to a Talmid Chacham. And they asked, I believe it was, they asked Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, one of the chief rabbis, sorry, chief rabbis, to do the Masarah Kedushin to make the bracha. And he said, I'm going to make the bracha, but I want everybody to answer Amen to my bracha. But the Chatan Kala should not answer Baruch Hu Shema. They shouldn't say Baruch Hu Shema in the middle of the bracha because they want to be Yotzei. They're trying to fulfill their mitzvah. So usually when we hear Kiddush on Friday night, something like that, we don't say Baruch Hu Shema. So they don't answer. The Bava Sali, one of the Gedolim, the Bukhaseris, he said, no, the Moroccans have the practice to say Baruch Hu Shema, even if you're being Yotzei, even if you're fulfilling the mitzvah. And Rumorchai said, but it's not the best minhag. Let's just do what the halacha is. And the Rav Sali said, I'm going to leave my own daughter's wedding unless I'm going to follow this minhag. I want everybody to make sure to follow this practice. Okay, so that was what they did. I think Rav Amar said this story later. Other people heard and saw this story. Anyway, amongst the Moroccans, we're going to see there's another style amongst the poskin. So let me give a few examples to make this a little clearer. Rav Haigon was asked in a tshuva about why do you blow shofar 100 blows, so many blows? And this is what bothers some people today with Minhagim is, it seems not to make sense. Why do we have so many doubts of how to blow the shofar? The Gemara gives, we're supposed to blow, it says in Torah three times, blowing the shofar. We say, well, maybe it's this way to blow the Torah, maybe it's Tikiyah, maybe it's Shvarim Torah. Where it says, okay, nine combinations. Then we multiply it by three, and then we make, with every Tikiyah, every Torah comes with a Tikiyah, and then we package it, and we add an extra Gedol. So someone asked Rav Haigon, come on already, I don't want to have to hear I'm getting a headache from all the shofar blowing. I don't want to listen. Just, I want to hear three, and end of story. So, Rav Haigon said, you should know the ikar of halacha is look at the practice. And afterwards, you want to ask me kashas from the Gemara, you want to ask me questions, why do we do this? Doesn't make sense? I'll answer you. But you should rest assured, if you ever have a question and you notice the minhag, you should know that you should follow that. And it's your shalmi now, it's a question how far you take the shalmi. Pukhazi mayam adover. Anytime, kol makom sha halacha refefe biyadcha. Anytime you're not sure of the halacha, go look what people do. And he says, what about the Gemaras? I'll answer the Gemaras. In fact, the Rav Haigon has a beautiful approach. His approach is to shofar. It was not a safek. He says, all of the blows are, each one is correct. Every single one of them is adding another level of something. It's not like the Rambam. The Rambam, in fact, says it is a safek. We're not sure how to do them. Anyway, that's Rav Haigon. Another example is that famous story. It goes like this. Hillel, the Hillel in the days of the Gemara, was learning in Bavel, and he decided to come to Eretz Yisrael one time to learn some Torah, and he saw it was Erev Pesach, it was the days of the Beis HaMikdash, and it was going to be a Shabbat Erev Pesach. And usually on Erev Pesach, there was millions of Jews, lots of Jews coming to the Beit HaMikdash and bringing their sheep and bringing their knives and going to do the Korban Pesach. However, on Shabbat, how are they supposed to do this? Are they supposed to do the Pesach on Shabbat? Or this year they're going to skip it? They're going to miss the Pesach. What are they supposed to do? They didn't know. So they asked B'nai B'tir, they asked the prince, the Nasi. B'nai B'tir, what do you say on this? They didn't know the answer. Hillel said, he was a visitor, a guest at the time, he said, hey, I heard a tradition that we're supposed to do it even on Shabbat. Beautiful. B'nai B'tir said, wow, it's so impressive. How'd you know that? And he started giving Kavach Omers and Gezer Shabbos and reasons. And they kept asking questions back and forth. And he said, come on, you said that was halacha, but we're not sure anymore. Are you right? He said, I'll tell you, I'm certain I'm right. I have a Masorah, I have a tradition. Generation to generation, going Shemaya Naftalion. I'm certain that's what they said. And what are you supposed to say about bringing the knife? Are you allowed to carry a knife on Shabbat for the Pesach? And he said, skipping to long story short, he said, look, I don't know the answer, but look what the people are going to do. And he looked around, and the people put the knife in the hair of the sheep. They stuck it into the wool of the sheep, and they were walking. The sheep was carrying the knife stuck in the wool. And he said, oh, now that I saw this, I remember that's exactly what Shemayin Avtalion said that you should do. In Enam Nevi'im, if the people are not prophets, B'nai Nevi'im. So he says, you know what the halacha is? Look around what the minhag is. That's an important precedent for the strength of minhagim. And when the chachamim like a minhag, that's the phrase they use. Im einu nevi'im, b'nei nevi'im. If you see a practice, you're not sure what it is. Sometimes we do toss out minhagim. But if you're not sure about the halacha to begin with, so you look at the minhag and you say, im einu nevi'im, if they're not prophets, maybe they're children of prophets. Now get to the point, basically. The Torah quotes a minhag that people would not work on all of Hanukkah. I can't even imagine in 2020 doing such a thing. People have a hard enough time taking off on doctors, but certainly besides the lawyers and business, taking off time from work for Yom Tov. And if you're going to also, Chol Moed, Halavai, you're going to try maybe an extra day for Purim, you don't even have to. Tisha B'Av, don't exactly have to, but it's good. Now you're going to take all of Hanukkah? Okay, whatever it was, there was a practice, they decided not to work all of Hanukkah. And the Torah says, look, if that's your, it's not the chiyuv, you don't have to do this, but if that's your town practice, the minhag, you have to follow the practice. The Beit Yosef says, what do you mean? How could you have a practice that's not based on anything? Even if they decided not to do that, there's no reason it should be binding as a minhag. The Pri Chadash, a Talmud in Egypt in the 1600s, Talmud of the Radvaz, chief rabbi in Egypt, and he had a tremendous harifut for all the Gedolim, and happened to be his contemporaries, when they saw the work he put on Yoredeya, he wrote such a tremendous work. And he argued a lot to Rishonim and Achronim, he had many, many sources for everything. When people saw his work, the contemporary Sfaradim put his book in Cherem, excommunication, they said, he's such a great, but how could he argue on Shulchan Aruch a few generations before? How could he argue? They didn't look at his book. Happened to be the Vilna Gaon. It was one of the very instrumental works that quoted him and brought him back. The Pri Chadash wrote a kuntris on Minhagim, and he said like this. He said, what do you do with a Minhag that is against Halacha? He says like this. I'll bring you two Gemarot, and we're going to summarize. The two Gemarot go like this. One Gemara says that the people, when they're doing miser on carob fruit, Rabbi Yochanan says that they really should do one halacha. They should follow the opinion, one halacha, the Rabbanan. And Reish Lakish says, no, the minhag is like the other way. And Reish Lakish says, yeah, that's the minhag. And Rabbi Yochanan said, in this Rosh Hashanah Daf Tevav, Rabbi Yochanan said, the minhag is like that. And Reish Lakish said, yeah, but why should they follow the minhag? It's against the Mishnah. It's against the majority opinion. And the Gemara says, so what's the big deal? it's against the majority opinion, but so what? But is relying on somebody, and it's the minhag. What's the problem? The Gemara says, you can't allow a minhag to go on and continue if it's against the majority opinion. So that's the Prichadash's ultimate major opinion. He says, a minhag against halacha, you get out your baseball bat, and anybody decides not to follow you, forget them. That's the Prichadash. Now the Marik, who was a Rishon in the 1400s, he didn't go that way. He assumed that you could follow minhag. Now where did he come from? He had a different Gemara Tani Chafchet, that says like this: Rav, one of the Marim, once visited Bavel. It was Rosh Chodesh. I have this in the sources, so I'm going to share my screen. In Bavel, they were saying Hallel on Rosh Chodesh, and they were saying Hallel, and Rav didn't understand what this was all about. What are you saying Hallel on Rosh Chodesh? There's no such thing. It doesn't say that in the Torah. On Yom Tov, very nice, but Rosh Chodesh, it's not a holiday. What are you doing? And he was about to get up to the shtender and stop them and protest. And then he saw they were skipping paragraphs. And he said, oh, skipping paragraphs? Ah, it's a minhag. I'm not going to touch it. Says the Marik, okay, what's a minhag? But they made a bracha levatalah. And he said, what are they doing making a bracha on the halal? You see, minhagim, it's you're allowed to do things, even if they're a little bit problematic for a minhag. Prichadash says, no way, it means bracha levatalah is only derabana, and that's why they're allowed. Very interesting. Anyway, the Rabban raised the Gemara, they didn't even make a bracha on that howl, they skipped the bracha. That's a major Sephardi Ashkenazi dispute. That's where the post can begin. Do we follow this Prichadash approach, and we go with the pristine halacha, and everybody else has to fall in line, or we go with the Maharik approach? Chacham Avadya follows the Prichadash, and the approach of Or Lezion is much more to follow Rav Eliashiv, much more to, well, Rav Eliashiv sometimes yes, sometimes no, but much more to follow the approach of the Maharik. Sometimes we will accept a minhag as long as there's some opinion, some way to justify it. For example, a little bit like Rav Shachter of Willig, a style in their approach is, Rav Shachter is much more into the halacha is the halacha, and Rav Willig more into the minhag. Rav Eliashiv and Rav Shlomo Zalman into the minhag, and Rav Eliashiv into the halacha. Now, I want to just bring out some sources and answer my two questions, my three questions I began with. How do you evaluate, three questions, the third question was, how do you evaluate which minhag is good and which is not good? How do Rav Moshe know how to say, gibrox all year, forget that's a silly minhag. But yeah, when it comes to Rav Hai going about doing 100 blows, shofar blows, we say, that's tradition, of course we do such a thing. Ikar min hakarid, forget the gemaras. We don't die from a kash on a gemara, but you keep the minhag, that's what Rav Hai going said. So how do you know to evaluate? The answer is, you take different approaches and somewhere in between. Approaches that everybody agrees is, halakha that's totally anti-Torah, the conservative, minhag alokher halakha, we don't take that in lagamre. The Gra takes that only when it comes to disputes by Mamon, or it comes to Kavod Sibur. Certain things we limit that Gemara when we say minhag alokher halakha. If someone wants to do a different haftorah, certain practices we use minhag. But not when it comes to absolute things against the Gemara, against the halakha completely. Now, that's how they evaluate minhagim. We had different solid approaches between the Prichadash, on the one hand, a purist, and Maharik, in the other hand. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the son of the Rav, has an essay on this. And he talks about Sephardim versus Ashkenazim, more or less. Ashkenazim more often were into the approach of the minhag, and Sephardim more into the approach of the purist. Now, he says today, it happens to be the reason that that people are more into chumras, he suggests, is because of the purist approach. Everybody started, it became popular to follow the Chacham Avadya approach, the Prichadash approach. They have to be a purist, follow all the svarim, follow all the opinions. So that's why it comes out a lot of times to be a chumra, forget the minhagim. Some people say whatever, Chaim Soloveitchik, according in there, is that the joke that goes that rabbi, whatever, went to his rebbetzin and said, why are you doing this in the kitchen? What you're doing is treif. It's not kosher. How can you do this? It says in Shulchan Aruch, not like that. And she said, nonsense. Of course, this is the way my mother did that. And no one's going to teach me otherwise. That's not just a joke. That's probably the way it was for centuries. The minhag is that there should be dispute. There should be different approaches. Anyway, I want to answer my first questions about why was there a practice in Shemayim not to eat, and practice down here that we eat. And we learn from that minhagim. The Rabbeinu B'chai has an amazing idea. He says, and this connects to the gematria of minhag, is 64. Also the gematria of din, judgment, is 64. And that idea of 64 din, din is in Sfirot of Kabbalah, the second of the Sfirot, is associated with Yitzchak Avinu. Now, why would we associate din, judgment, strict judgment, with Minagim? I would think, you know, Minago Kera Halacha, or the other way, but why are they the same gematria? And also Halacha is 60. If you add 4 for the 4 letters of Halacha, 4 letters make 64. Why is it that way? Rabbeinu Bachai says an amazing thing. He says, if you think about Yitzchak Avinu, if someone wanted to make a Steven Spielberg production on Yitzchak Avinu, would it be a great sequel to the Avraham Avinu, you know, and the trilogy, and a great great movie? Hardly it would be even a carbon copy of the Avraham Avinu story. Yitzchak Avinu's story, the approach we have to Yitzchak Avinu, seems to be very dull, boring. There's nothing new happening. It's all just a repeat of what Avraham did. Why do we need to know, for example, it says in the Torah, and spends a lot of psukim, the only story we really know so much about Avram, but Yitzchak, is he dug the same wells that his father dug. And he named it the same names. He couldn't be so creative to come up with a new name. What do we need? Why did the Torah make a big deal? Says Rabbeinu Bachai, I'll tell you why. Godol HaMinhagim, the Minhagim are so precious, and the Chiddushei Arim expands and elaborates. Avram was teaching the world such a precious thing. He said, look, you look at the human body and it looks plain. It looks mundane, nothing special. We're here now, and tomorrow we're gone, we may as well enjoy ourselves. And he said, look, deep inside the recesses of yourself is a neshama. There's something deeper in the world. The world looks dry and barren. There's nothing here. It's just a desert. He said, deep down is a bare mayim chaim, is a fountain of life, of water. That's why Avraham Avinu dug wells, to teach everybody the lesson that there's much more than meets the eye inside a person. Alam katan, a person is a small world. And Yitzchak Avinu saw that the plishtim didn't want to learn that lesson. They didn't just steal the wells. They filled them in to teach everybody. What you see is what you get. The earth is just plain. And Rabbeinu Chai says he had to name it by the name of his father to teach you the gadol haminhag. And din, which is associated with Yitzchak, was the entire lesson of Yitzchak Avinu's legacy. And Rosenzweig has a lot of points, and he has a whole essay on this idea. There is a tremendous godless to Yitzchak Avinu. Yitzchak Avinu was the ultimate follower of followers, and it couldn't be Judaism without that. And that's what the tremendous minhag is all about, is to add and to elaborate and to expand upon the halakha and the initiative, sort of, that Avraham Avinu had, the pioneerism that he had. Only he came to fruition with the Yitzchak Avinu that brought it to fruition. Now, to answer my questions, the first question, why was there a minhag in Shemaim of not eating and here eating? The Yitzchak Moshe says because in Kabbalah, a person eats, takes out Kedusha, extracts Kedusha in every bite he takes. They say the Kaf HaChaim took an hour to eat, because every bracha he made, he had tremendous Kabbalah that was mala, the Kedusha, in every food. So when the angels come down here, they see this, they should follow our practice. And when Moshe went up to Shemaim, they said they weren't touched with spiritual reality. We don't need to do that. That's the minhag of the ground and the minhag of Shemayim. And for the second question, why do we sometimes follow minhagim that expire? The reason, the answer is, a little bit what Sally brought in the beginning, sometimes the minhag has a little bit of justification in and of itself, that we should follow the way that all the other Jews were following. Now we're going to say, if it's against halakha, then we're going to have to evaluate it based on the different post-scheme. I want to come back to some of this next week. And elaborate more on the expiration of Minhagim, because in fact, even though I sat over here, usually we keep Minhagim even when they don't make sense. There are going to be exceptions when Minhagim expire that somehow we could change. But I want to talk about changing Minhagim more next week. If anything wasn't clear, please ask. Any questions, thoughts?
About the kidney, when we go, that I married Alan, it's crazy. In America, it's fine because everything here is so easy. So I don't eat rice year-round, really. It's not a big thing. But when you go to Israel, it's impossible to not eat kidney. It's impossible. You find the two restaurants there that are good, but you feel like it just sounds, it's crazy. And the same with the 1 and 2 days. That's another issue, and depends on which rabbi you ask, and we got the 1 day, and we're very happy with that, but it's the things that we know for sure now, the way things are calculated and all that, there's no suffix to when the holiday starts or, you know, so it does seem passé for the, you know, it's nice to be able to, what you mentioned, certain things from Minhagim, but something like kidney oat, every time I'm in Israel, Pesach, it just seems like get with the time.
Okay, here are the questions. Right?
Probably will change. Kidney oat will be...
You know what? Alan has cousins in Israel who are Ashkenaz who will use the oil, but not actual, and, you know, things like that that are not derivative. You know, they're all... Everyone starts making their own rules because it's really impossible to be in Israel and not eat kidney oat.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
We gotta run outside and ring and start 8:05.
Okay, Chazai Baruch, Salo, thank you for joining.
Thank you very much for coming, everybody.
I know I rushed a little bit at the end, but thank you for joining.
Okay.